what is it called again?
They got
variant of originalism.
Yes,
that says because the Confederate states weren't involved in the drafting of them and the processing of them, that it doesn't really count.
They don't count. They want to get rid of them. Mm-mm. So people better pay attention to really what's going on.
That sounds whack, but that's how whack it is. It's crazy.
And they are whack, and they're moving their whack agenda. And most people think this is a regular election, or this is just between, you know, Democrats and Republicans on minor issues like guns or abortion. This is well beyond.
Yeah.
This is well beyond those issue politics. So
yeah.
I hope people pay attention to it and get out and vote.
I'm tracking my ballot. It's supposed to be in the mail on the 28th, so I'm thinking it'll be in my mailbox when I get home today.
All right, let the clerk know.
I'm glad there's another scenario in case it does get lost in the mail. Okay, good to hear that. You guys have a great day, and everybody out in the audience too. We're going to kick it off with Mumi Abu-Jamal. I've got Greg Palast on the 12th Amendment gambit. Something completely different, a structural thing. There's a group in England, and they're working with people here. They're looking at reparations for the slave trade and colonialism even. It'll be... I hadn't heard anything about it, but so we're going to hear from some left Christian groups. And it's something completely different, and a structural thing that will take us away from... Well, not really away from the day-to-day politics, because it underlies everything, right? The inequity in the system. Okay, here's Mumi Abu-Jamal with his insights, and it is indeed the counting where it matters. There is an argument out there that, you know, the poll, exit poll showed that the election didn't go to Trump, and a lot of people say that's because Trump voters were embarrassed about admitting, even after the fact, that they had voted for Trump, that there was a fraction of them. But it's just as plausible, and maybe even more plausible, that the provisional ballots that were thrown out actually reflect the difference. So the Republicans in this county are probably going to still try to label those ballots that were in question in this lawsuit as provisional ballots in some way. Maybe the ones that have the Facebook identical names, which is also used in the voting rolls and canceling, throwing out ballots. So it wasn't just the Electoral College that might have been jury-rigged. It was the fact that provisional ballots weren't counted. I guess I'm not talking loud enough here. I'm still behind my mask. Have to do protocols here before I can take it off. Here's Mumi Abu-Jamal.
Beyond the polls. In a few days, the roiling elections of 2020 will be history. But what kind of history will it be? No one really knows. For certainty is but a feeling, not a fact. But what about the polls, you ask? Polls are polls, and 2016 had the same sense of certainty and somewhat similar polls. Thanks in part to the then director of the FBI, James Comey. A news release made just days before the election sent Hillary Clinton's campaign into a tailspin. She crashed and burned, leading to the unexpected rise of Trump. Given the speed and the power of social media, anything can happen in the blink of an eye. So the stage is not yet set. Tomorrow's script is not yet written. People vote, yes, but it ain't the voting that matters. It's the counting, especially in a so-called democracy. For tomorrow belongs to those who fight the hardest today. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Count on the national popular vote, not the Electoral College. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Donald Trump may be the last loser to win through the Electoral College. Two of the last three presidencies, Trump's included, have gone to the candidate who lost the popular vote. In 2000, the Supreme Court halted the Florida recount, handing the election to George W. Bush. It was later determined Vice President Al Gore actually won the election by 500,000 votes. In 2016, Hillary Clinton received almost 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but Trump still won. These victories, where the loser wins, were made possible through the Electoral College, one of the U.S. Constitution's key anti-democratic provisions. The 55 white men who drafted the Constitution in 1787, many of whom were slaveholders, envisioned a democracy, but they didn't trust the masses to choose the right president. So they created the Electoral College. Now, more than 230 years later, a mass movement is building to elect the president through a national popular vote. In December 2000, while the U.S. Supreme Court was deciding on the Florida recount in the Bush v. Gore case, the late legendary historian Howard Zinn appeared on the Democracy Now! NewsHour to shed some light on this little-understood entity, the Electoral College. He described the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia.
When it came to the question of how to elect the president, there was a rather lively debate over how the president should be elected and how many years should the president serve and should there be a vice president and so on. And there were several proposals made that the president should be simply elected by popular vote. And those proposals were immediately knocked down, which was not surprising because the founding fathers were really not inclined to have a real popular choice of the people who would run our government.
Instead, they devised a plan whereby state legislatures would appoint electors who would meet amongst themselves on a state-by-state basis to choose the president, forming a firewall between the voters and the election of the president. At that time, the voters consisted of a very select group of mostly white landowning men. A few states allowed free black men to vote as well.
My name is Alexander Hamilton.
Alexander Hamilton, whose achieved star status is the subject of Lin-Manuel Miranda's blockbuster musical Hamilton, defended the decision to create the Electoral College, writing in Federalist Papers 68 that the electors, who would deliberate in a, quote, judicious manner, would weed out presidential contenders who were unfit for office. He wrote, "Talents for low intrigue and the little arts of popularity may alone suffice to elevate a man to the first honors in a single state, but it will require other talents and a different kind of merit to establish him for the distinguished office of President of the United States," Hamilton wrote. If the Electoral College was intended to protect the nation from a president skilled at low intrigue and the little arts of popularity, it clearly failed in 2016. Each state receives a number of electors equal to the number of senators and representatives it has in Congress. Since 1961, the 23rd Amendment gave the District of Columbia three electors as well. The states grant their electors to whatever presidential candidate wins the popular vote in their state. In all but two of the states, it's winner take all. It's this system that's driven presidential campaigns to focus almost entirely on a handful of so-called swing states, places where either a Republican or Democratic candidate has a chance of winning. The other 40 or so states are generally ignored by the campaigns as the allocation of their electoral votes is a foregone conclusion. For example, California, Oregon, and Washington are blue states, and Mississippi and Alabama are seen as red states. Modern voters, most of whom believe a president should be popularly elected, are joining together, state by state, to overcome the historical aberration of the Electoral College. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is a plan to achieve that. It doesn't do away with the Electoral College. Scrapping it entirely would require the difficult, lengthy constitutional amendment process. Instead, each state that adopts the compact passes a law that says its electors will go to whichever candidate wins the national popular vote in the country as a whole, regardless of what candidate wins in that particular state. The compact won't take effect until enough states adopt it so that the aggregate of their electoral votes equals 270 or more, enough to guarantee the presidency to the most popular candidate. To date, 15 states and the District of Columbia have passed the law, amassing a total of 196 electoral votes. When states with a total of 74 electoral votes or more join the compact, the dysfunction of the Electoral College system will come to an end. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Indeed. There are some other amendments to the Constitution I would like to see, and I hope they all get represented Organic something is the name for this theory that the amendments, the post-Civil War amendments, are illegitimate. I'll browse my Facebook postings in that and try to get that discussion out. Howard Zinn, great to hear him. He really strikes a nerve with a lot of people. Like, we don't need to revise and extend our view of history. Here's Greg Palast. I'm going to go right to this and get as much of it on as I can. I've got a section of the Task Cask, which I'll probably excerpt. I didn't mention also from Sonali Kahatar, producer out at KPFK LA, Pacifica's fourth station in order of coming into being. An interview about the international dimension of the anti-abortion issue. She's had something on this before, and I've played something on it, but this is a new view. Sekulow, Trump's personal lawyer, is with this group that has its tentacles all over the world, including in Poland. In fact, they filed a brief in the Constitutional Court of Poland that has caused all this uproar over there. It's already a very highly restricted access to abortion, but now it's even gotten worse in Poland. So controversial issues, opinions you hear are those of the speakers. This is an excerpt of a four-part election theft report. I haven't actually reviewed most of it, so I cut to the chase on the 12th, and just the idea of purging the votes, provisional ballots or otherwise. Greg Powell's been following that for a while. I haven't gone to the election theft report. They've had their fundraiser and haven't actually had it, but they're making up for it in the lead up to the election. The election theft report, variously called at times, it seems.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat. But we have it so well under control. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax.
Well, I think treatment in many ways might be more exciting.
You know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
You are an idiot. Oh, 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 oh.
All right. Well, you know, what we just heard and what we're talking about when we're talking about purged, votes purged, where is the struggle here?
Well, you know, there's this TV show called The Purged, and once a year you get to kill anyone you want. Well, it's kind of based on a somewhat true story. That is, once a year, mostly Republican voting officials, secretaries of state from Georgia to South Carolina, remove voters that they don't want. They purge them. That is, they cancel voter registration. 16.7 million voters, that's the official number from the government, over the past 2 years have been purged from the voter rolls. By the way, it's gotten to the point where the actual number of Democrats registered has declined over 4 years, while Republicans have gone up because of erasure of people from the voter rolls. And what you just heard, Dennis, by the way, that was narrated, and thank you, Yvette Nicole Brown, and hosted a release by Leonardo DiCaprio at his Instagram site, if you want to see it. And I want to, let me just plug one thing. Go to gregpalast.com and see the full film, which is about 13 minutes long, and also with Deborah Messing. So you see, you can meet the people who have been purged. So it's about removing you from the voter rolls. This is a hidden thing. The Democratic Party's out there with lawyers to help you on election day. Well, if you've been removed from the voter rolls, for the most part, you're out of luck. You can have 12 lawyers with you. They're not going to let you vote.
So how do you Are there legitimate reasons to remove people from the roles, or is this just sort of 21st century Jim Crowism?
The answer is it's Jim Crow. Well, it's not Jim Crow. That's like, you know, white, you know, people in white sheets threatening you with nooses. This is now, they've gone from white sheets to spreadsheets. This is Dr. James Crow, systems analyst. And, you know, you look at states, and by the way, it's not small, like Michigan. 313,000 people were purged from the voter rolls last year. Wisconsin, they're trying to remove 129,000. That's six times Trump's victory margin there. The amount of voters removed in Michigan is ready 30 times Trump's victory margin in Michigan in 2016. Places like North Carolina, Georgia, these have been, and Georgia, which is a swing state, the ACLU issued my report identifying by name 198,351 voters, a third of a million voters, not just removed, but I can guarantee you I have the names and addresses of voters wrongly removed. The ACLU and I have given this number, and also Black Voters Matter, given the names, given the information to the Georgia Secretary of State, a Republican, frankly, a Republican hack. Who is just, you know, shrugging his shoulders, saying, yeah, maybe we'll fix it up. Talk to me after Tuesday. That's what's going on.
Now, and it's not going on there. You're part of a Wisconsin study. Yes. Break that down for us. That has a lot to do with racism in its current form.
Yes, they're all these are various tricks that they use to remove you. You know, they can't just say, "Oh, we don't like Dennis Bernstein," or "We don't like people named James Brown," because they are African American, obviously. They have to have an excuse. And in Wisconsin, they use something called the Eric List. It's a list of people who supposedly moved. Now, they got this from a little coterie. It's a very secretive little list put together by a coterie of GOP officials, mostly. And in Wisconsin, I went through the list name by name. And it was about people who supposedly moved, Dennis. You know, obviously, if you left Milwaukee, you can't vote in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's a crime. But we went through the names. We went through 153,000 names. 100,000 of those people had never moved, never left Milwaukee. If you didn't leave Milwaukee, you can vote there. And in fact, on the list was Saquana Taylor. I confronted her. You'll see this if you go to, again, gregpalace.com and watch The Purged. Saquana Taylor, they said, left Milwaukee. Dennis, she's a Milwaukee County supervisor. I don't think she left Milwaukee. I'm laughing because it's so ridiculous, but it's also tragic. Of course, needless to say, she was attempting to vote while black. So they took her out in Wisconsin. In fact, if you go to our film, we did an analysis of every census tract where they were pulling voters out in Milwaukee. And it was a perfect match between the blackest census districts in Milwaukee and the number of people wrongly purged. And I want to emphasize, wrongly removed from the voter rolls for moving. What happens is, and by the way, Dennis, if you do move, you don't lose your vote necessarily if you move within your neighborhood. As you know, renters, low-income people move within buildings, within their neighborhood. If you move within your county, you can't, under federal law, lose your vote. But that doesn't matter to these cats. Now, I will say in Milwaukee, you've had some resistance by the new Democratic-controlled government, particularly at the urging of the African-American lieutenant governor, Mandela Barnes. He's made an issue of it. But you see these games. Look, in Georgia, they removed 100, like I say, we identified 198,000 people wrongly removed. And that was on the cockamamie grounds. Again, the people have moved. And that included the woman you heard crying. Her grandmother was included. Her grandmother, the woman said there's no record of her ever having voted. They wiped her out the voter rolls. This is Christine Jordan, Martin Luther King's then 92-year-old cousin. I went to the home, Dennis, where they said she had moved out of. I went there. She had pictures of Martin Luther King on the wall, having dinner with her at that home where that she supposedly moved from. Overwhelmingly, it's almost an exact match of race, and there's a second group, young people, young voters. I spoke to a voter in, and that's the other thing, like in Wisconsin, they're targeting the students in Madison, Wisconsin. And we talked to a guy named Pio Qua from whose parents were from Vietnam, and he moved two doors down. You know, students move dorm room to dorm room. They couch surf. That's not against the Constitution. Doesn't say you lose your vote because you moved your dorm room. You know, again, right. It sounds goofy and funny, but this could pick our president.
All right, listen, we're just about out of time, and we can't get out of here without, on this Election Crimes Bulletin, saying at least a strong, what can you do, Greg? What are you recommending? Here we are. It's a couple of days away. What are you recommending people to do to fight for their vote if they want to throw down?
Two things. Number one, if you live in California, and most of your listeners are in California, you can vote. They don't tell you this necessarily. You can actually register when you go in to vote in California. Don't, if you've been purged, as I was in California, by the way, you can go in and register when you go in to vote. So bring ID and proof of address. In Michigan and Wisconsin, also, when you go in to vote, if they say you've been purged, and they don't tell you this usually, and most people don't know this, you can register. Say, well, then I want to register on the spot. Don't take one of those provisional ballots where, you know, it likely won't get counted. Do take, say, I want to re-register. California, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, these are swing states. North Carolina. North Carolina is a little bit different. You can only register when you go in to vote on early voting. I tell everyone to go in on early voting. That's when you got to vote, because you wait till Tuesday, you got some lines, baby. But so many states, these swing states, do allow, and California, allow same-day registration for your vote. You can take action here.
Well played. The 12th Amendment says that if no one gets 270 electoral votes, it goes to the House. Now, I know some people say, well, then Nancy Pelosi picks our president. Sorry, Jack. It's one state, one vote. California gets one vote, and so does South Carolina. At the moment, Trump has 26, the Republicans control 26 state delegations, the Democrats 23 or 24, depending on how you count it. In other words, Trump's reelected if no one gets these electoral votes.
All right, let me jump in there, because we want people to understand that this is not just fantasy of Palestine Bernstein, but this is on the mind of your president of the United States. And I believe, Mike, you have the sound there of Trump reflecting on the 12th.
And all I'm asking is people go out to vote, and stop with this nonsense, because we're going to be counting ballots for the next 2 years. And I don't want to end up in the Supreme Court, and I don't want to go back to Congress either. Even though we have an advantage if we go back to Congress. Does everyone understand that? I think it's 26 to 22 or something, because it's counted one vote per state. So we actually have an advantage. Oh, they're going to be thrilled to hear that. I'm sure they're trying to figure out how can we break that one. Biden wants to confiscate your guns and indoctrinate your children with poisonous anti-American lies in schools, right?
All right, and Trump, it's definitely, he's been briefed. Can't deny
clearly.
It. Right, Greg?
Clearly, our president, Agent Orange, has been briefed on the 12th. Clearly, that's their Hail Mary pass. And here's what I'm concerned about. He related it to mail-in voting. Now, let's unpack what this guy has said. It takes a long, you can count mail-in votes quickly if there's no challenges, if there's no problems. But remember, in New York, in just the primary, they never got through the count of the ballots in 7 weeks. Generally, California takes a month and rarely gets through all the mail-in ballots in our state. And we're pro mail-in. So imagine in Georgia, imagine in Pennsylvania, Michigan, et cetera, where you have armed, quote, poll watchers. Remember that we've had a president call for poll watchers. That is, and he's also told the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by. This is what they are there for, to go in and be poll watchers and basically intimidate the vote counters to stop the counting of the mail-in ballots. Trump will certainly, almost certainly will win on the in-person voting on Election Day. He's going to say that's it, and then basically his guys are going to try to slow up the count. Understand, to elect a president, you have to have all the mail-in votes counted and certified. In Florida, they only have about 11 days to count all the ballots. That's a lot less time than it normally takes. And if they slow it up, now we've had this, Dennis, before. Back in 2000, if you remember, a guy named Roger Stone, I wonder whatever happened to him. Roger Stone led what was called the Brooks Brothers riot. He took a bunch of consultants and lawyers. They literally went in and started smashing up, or threatening to smash up, the Miami-Dade clerk's office. That stopped the vote count in the Bush-Gore race in Miami. And the next day, the Republican Secretary of State, Katherine Harris, who was also Bush's campaign chairwoman, she said, we have to certify the vote. I'm certifying it now. George Bush is ahead by 537 votes. He wins Florida. He's now president. That was it. And they left 178,000 ballots uncounted. A lot of that because of violence in that Miami-Dade counting office. Imagine if they start this stuff up all over the country, in Detroit, in Milwaukee, in Philadelphia, in Tallahassee, and in Miami, in these swing states. Here's the danger. If there is no finishing of the count, these GOP secretaries of state who are in charge there and the legislatures get to say, that's it, we're certifying where we are. And they can either pick Trump, or they can all say, there's so many fraudulent votes, picking up the Trump line, 100,000, you know, we can't tell where these votes are coming from. So we're not going to pick a winner. Even if the exit polls, even if the numbers are showing Biden ahead, even if they have to call the election, stop the count with Biden ahead, they can say there's too many fraudulent votes. We're simply not certifying this election. No one gets 270, and it goes to the House. Unfortunately,
and again, it's one state, one vote.
One state, one vote. So Oklahoma is going to get the same vote as New York. Good luck. God bless America. Now, of course, there are other tricks, because what happens? Remember, this vote won't be taken till the new Congress is in session, and Pelosi is trying hard to flip those delegations. She is very aware, she said, of the 12th Amendment. And so she's, you know, what if the Democrats do flip the House delegations? They're three states short. There are other tricks that they can use in the Constitution to pick Donald Trump despite the will of the voters. And one is called, one is Article 2. Yeah, so Article 2 of the Constitution. I'm sure that you know it right offhand.
I got it written just in case I forget any word.
Yeah, I know. I have my kids recite these things. But Article 2 says that the state legislatures pick the electoral delegates. It doesn't say that they have to go by the vote of the people. When this country started, we didn't have a direct vote for the president, even electorally. So the legislatures choose the electors. And it doesn't, and it is, there's no restriction. It doesn't matter how people vote in a state. The only restrictions are the state laws. There's no federal right to vote in the Constitution, period. So if the electors say, look, as far as we're concerned, these Biden votes are all from Venezuela and they're fraudulent, we're picking Trump, period. That's the Second Amendment. Remember, Thomas Jefferson didn't imagine that we would have a reality TV show star who would like to start an insurrection by Twitter account. So this was not imagined by our founding fathers. So that's the second. And then, are you ready? If that fails them, they've got a third trick, which has never been used, called the Electoral Count Act of 1887. And I'm sure that you've got that one memorized too, Dennis. All I can tell you with the Electoral Count Act of 1887, if there is, you could have, for example, competing legislative bodies, you know, send in competing slates, or a governor, like a Democratic governor of Michigan, can send in, say, Biden won our state and send in electors. The legislature says we're sending in electors. At that point, under the Electoral Count Act, it could go back to the governors, it could go back to the legislatures, it could be decided by the House or the Senate. It's really quite complex. And anyone who tells you what it means has no idea. The only person that has to know what it means is called Amy Covid Barrett, and she's going to take her seat on Tuesday. That's why they were so desperate. No one has ever interpreted the Electoral Count Act of 1887. That will be up to the Supremes with Amy Covid Barrett as vote 6 of the right-wing cabal. I don't know how else to put it.
Denying climate change, but it could very well go back. You know, we're talking about over millions of years. They say that we had hurricanes that were far worse than what we just had with Michael.
Who says that? They say.
I mean, people say that.
Yeah, but what about the scientists who say it's worse than ever?
It really is true.
Okay. They did a four-part series on election theft, and that was a new one to me. I heard a friend of mine read an article that said there are like 10 or 11 scenarios for finessing the vote of the popular vote. We'll see. I'm going to excerpt two pieces, and I'm likely to play them tomorrow because they're more internationally based. One of them is from this regular monthly that I go to, TaxCast, from Tax Justice Network, which prompts me to say, we need 60% plus one to pass the fair tax. What hasn't been done much is to look at other states. All the adjoining states except Indiana, who has a lower tax, flat tax than we do, but they have a county levied income tax that brings their effective, for most Hoosiers, up to Illinois tax rates, closer anyway. But all the other states, even Missouri, has a graduated income tax, and it just doesn't make any sense. I guess images and distortions are possibly going to win. And I'd forgotten about the 60 plus 1% too that's needed for a tax constitutional change. So anyway, that means that the flat tax will be raised, and all these people that are saying you're going after my income, et cetera, et cetera. All right, opinions expressed are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. We're going to go first to Sonali Kolhatkar, and I'll try and figure out where to excerpt it. You can find it at Rising Up with Sonali. She's all over social media, as she'll tell you here, I think, right at the beginning.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. If you thought that President Donald Trump's appointment of Judge Amy Coney Barrett was a threat to reproductive rights in the U.S. alone, a new investigation reveals that Barrett's positioning on the U.S. Supreme Court is part of a larger and extremely insidious global agenda. That agenda is aimed at women, LGBTQ people, and more. OpenDemocracy.net has just published and analyzed the first ever data set revealing the global scale of U.S. Christian right groups and how they're funding anti-abortion movements all over the world. These groups are intimately linked to people in Trump's orbit. Joining me to help explain this reporting is Nandini Archer. She is the Global Commissioning Editor at OpenDemocracy.net. She covers stories relating to gender, sexuality, feminism, and social justice. She's also an active member of the feminist direct action group Sisters Uncut, and she previously worked with the International Campaign for Women's Right to Safe Abortion. Welcome to the program, Nandini.
Thank you for having me.
So it seems as though this reporting links up to apparently disparate issues, which is Amy Coney Barrett on the U.S. Supreme Court and abortion issues in Poland, where the access to abortion was just made illegal and women in Poland are protesting in the streets. How are those two things linked through this network of Christian right groups based in the U.S.?
Yeah, so it's all really part of this kind of global Christian right machinery. I think with Amy Coney Barrett's nomination, what I've heard a lot in the UK about what commentators are saying in the US is that this kind of changes the US judicial system for a very long time, and that the impact of Trump is basically here to stay, whether or not he wins or loses next week. I think that what we've basically shown in this new investigation that we published this week is that, again, kind of that this is all part of a global coordinated attack on women's and LGBTQ rights. It's not just Barrett, it's not just Trump, it's not just these kind of boogeymen and women individuals. This is a whole system, a coordinated and globalized force. And I know that your president likes to talk about himself a lot and make it seem in some ways that he is at the forefront of these issues. And of course, he is their leader at the moment. But our new investigation has basically revealed that there's this global empire of $280 million of dark money that is flowing around the world. Many of the groups that we looked at are indeed linked to Trump. So one of them is actually Jay Sekulow's group. Yes, whether or not Trump wins in the election, these US Christian right dark money groups are ultimately here to stay, and they're not going anywhere. And if anything, I'd argue that if Trump does lose, these groups may be more likely to ramp up their game elsewhere. And we've seen this before. They seek to find new presidents in Poland, in Italy, in Uganda, wherever they can exert their influence, really.
Let's talk about Jay Sekulow. He's Trump's personal lawyer. Who is he, and how is he linked to some of these efforts in outside the United States that are pushing this anti-abortion agenda?
Yeah, so Jay Sekulow leads this group called American Center for Law and Justice. And they were one of the kind of 28 groups that we looked at in this huge global data set investigation. One of the things that this group does is kind of involve themselves in legal proceedings around the world. And one of the most recent court cases, which we've obviously has been in the news a lot recently, has been the Polish case. So yeah, that that's what they do. I think that what is kind of, you know, I've been watching what's been happening in Poland and kind of hooked on those videos and watching those, the feminists on the streets being really brave. And I think what's even more scary than those riot police vans and far right groups and military police opposing these women's reproductive rights and fighting them on the streets, really, is the fact that this is not just a Polish story. These kind of lawyers in the US have a influence there as well, which is what's really scary.
So just to give some backstory for our audience, it's now almost a week since thousands of women in Poland have been protesting after that nation's top court basically banned nearly all abortions across Poland. So women have been speaking out, they've been protesting, they've been facing repression, women and their allies, like we should mention. So how specifically, I mean, so is it that there are the groups like J Secular's group, the ACLJ, are giving money to help fund anti-abortion efforts in Poland? They're sort of sister organizations in Poland, if you will?
Yeah, so last week, Sekolo's group, the European branch, intervened actually directly.
Oh, so they have a European branch, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, called the European Center for Law and Justice. Hmm. And they actually intervened directly in the Polish Constitutional Court case last week that effectively banned abortion. They submitted arguments in support for banning abortion in cases of fatal fetal anomalies. And then these abortion cases already, they made up the vast majority of legal abortions in Poland, because Poland already had one of the most, one of Europe's most restrictive abortion laws. So it has effectively outlawed abortion. And yes, as you say, this has triggered days and days of protests that have really captured the world's attention. But I think, yeah, what's really scary is that these US groups are kind of experts at copy and pasting strategies against women's rights in one country to another. So even their Polish court filing was in fact copy and pasted from a previous anti-abortion submission they made to the United Nations Committee back in 2017. And so it's really quite bizarre that women's rights in Poland have become, have come into the crosshairs of this one US Christian conservative legal army that's connected to Trump.
And Amy Coney Barrett's positioning on the Supreme Court as well.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Which is to say that her positioning in the Supreme Court, her appointment and confirmation, is intended to bring about in the United States what Poland is going through, I imagine. I mean, you know, literally it was Poland's Supreme Court that banned abortion.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, these lawyers have said quite openly that they seek to find precedents in Europe and paste them onto America or the other way around. Hmm. I think that they say that they're really something quite explicit, like they're fighting against bad European precedents because they don't want them to spread into America. So there really is this this kind of cross-border effort, and they're quite explicit about that. I think what's really worrying and what we've seen in the rest of the world is that when these groups are not doing well in the US or not winning precedents or not kind of succeeding in their kind of ultra conservative efforts, they tend to then try elsewhere. And so my colleague in Uganda has been looking at what these groups have been doing.
Right. In fact, in African nations and Latin American nations, these groups have worked for years spending money to undermine access to contraception, undermine access to abortion, etc. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So my colleagues in Uganda and South Africa have looked at these groups spending in that region, and they funded things like kind of crisis pregnancy centers, which ultimately try and dissuade women from having abortions.
Right. In fact, if anybody wants to get a look inside a crisis abortion center, a really interesting place to start would be Borat's new film, which actually has a scene in a crisis pregnancy center. Not kid friendly, I should add.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I watched that recently, actually, and I was kind of, I mean, yeah, very surprised at the kind of how much that mirrored what we saw in other countries around the world. Earlier this year, we did an investigation across 18 countries where we sent undercover journalists into these centres across Uganda, from Uganda to Costa Rica to Italy and elsewhere, posing as young, vulnerable women. And actually, the things that they were told in all these different countries were remarkably similar. Things like, if you have an abortion, you could be what if you're killing the future president, like things like that. So it's
We've also heard that women are told that they're more susceptible to breast cancer if they get an abortion, all sorts of things. So the other misinformation that your investigation at opendemocracy.net points out is that some of these same groups that are funding through dark money networks, anti-abortion movements around the world, are also spreading misinformation on the coronavirus. Tell me about that.
Yeah, exactly. So in Latin America in particular, we found about half a dozen US Christian right groups who had poured millions of dollars into the region. And they had also promoted a lot of misinformation about COVID-19. And one group, for example, called it like the most monumental social engineering project of all time. They, of course, claimed that it was, you know, man-made in a Chinese lab and so on. They also kind of, we found a group that was spreading misinformation specifically about the WHO and saying that the WHO was using COVID-19 as a means to spread abortion or something. So really quite interesting, wild claims. And I think what's interesting is that the kind of abortion misinformation crisis pregnancy center investigation that I mentioned that we did earlier this year, we did that in kind of January, February, before this coronavirus crisis. And actually what that shows is that we found health misinformation against women on this kind of global scale was already, you know, it was happening then. And now kind of coronavirus has hit the news and so much has happened in the past like 6+ months that these groups are now kind of like focusing on that as their kind of health misinformation angle and somehow connecting it to abortion.
We know here in the United States, in fundamentalist circles, misogyny and homophobia go hand in hand. Do these same groups that are pushing to end access to abortion also push homophobic anti-LGBTQ policies?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think that they have ultimately a very strict worldview of what they perceive a man and a woman and marriage and so on should be. And all of the activities we've looked into are very much around kind of sex education, transgender rights, even divorce in some cases, also like IVF and surrogacy, anything really that steps outside of that kind of like woman plus man marriage, 2.5 kids or something. The things in particular that my colleague was looking into in Africa, it's just like extremely frightening that alongside these like crisis pregnancy centers, they're also supporting individuals who have said the most vitriolic homophobic stuff, like, you know, actually advocating for murdering LGBTIQ people. And again, I think we spoke to quite a few interesting kind of prominent LGBT activists in Uganda in particular, who say that this is a form of kind of imperialism. And again, basically these groups, they failed in their countries, so they're kind of exporting their hate elsewhere.
We talked about
Nadini Archer, possibly related to Jeffrey, I don't know. Opendemocracy.net is where this report is. She is the global commissioning editor, whatever that means. And I'm likely to play that in its entirety tomorrow, but you can find it by going to Rise Up with Sonali, Rising Up. This woman is also with Sisters Uncut, a feminist direct action group, which I have a link to on the page here that I will investigate. And then we're going to go back to the UK and with this like broader in-depth thing. This is left-wing Christians, perhaps they are. Perhaps they're just justice Christians who are working on this. The woman analyst is on a variety of Jubilee-type organizations, if you've heard of that one, and Friends groups in the UK as well, Quakers. And everybody's quaking now, so... going to hear just a bit of this, and this I might actually get to its entirety, but you can look for the tax cast, the latest reparations, justice.
Still shape some of today's predatory extractive business models and cultures. The Council for World Mission is a global partnership of Christian churches, and for a number of years now, they've been on a reparational justice journey. I'm talking with Reverend Dr. Peter Crutchley of the Council for World Mission, or CWM, and economist and reparations specialist Priya Luca. Let's start with why you at the Council for World Mission felt that you needed to make reparations and engage in restorative justice. I know that you were formerly known as the London Missionary Society, so that gives some clues.
We've been an organisation since 1795, And that's when the London Missionary Society began. We know that our history reaches before the end of the slave trade. And we've been working in the last 10 years, especially on an analysis of power relations, global issues through the image of empire. Even though we live in a decolonized context, the empire continues to shape our reality in different ways, economically, politically. And that also kind of turned us to think about our own particular story. The treasurer of the London Missionary Society, William Hankey, features in an ignominious moment in our nation's life, actually. He was invited to testify before the parliamentary select committee looking at manumission of slaves. And he goes in 1832 and justifies slavery. And he justifies evangelism among slaves on the basis that it made them better behaved and it made them more valuable in the slave market. So he makes this justification of enslavement using the London Missionary Society's work as key to that and key to his own personal aggrandizement. And as we know from all the recent work others, especially University College London, are doing, that names people who took compensation for the emancipation of the human beings they owned, that he received close to the equivalent of £560,000 in 2019 terms. Small London Missionary Society committees in London churches are outraged and appalled to hear this. And so he resigns. But actually, if you look at all the materials in our archive, whilst he steps down as treasurer, he continues to be involved in the London Missionary Society until his death 20 years later. And his own personal bank is the bank that the London Missionary Society used and continued to use after his death through his son. And the plantation that he owned in Jamaica was sold in 1954, and the proceeds from it come into Council for World Missions through one of our constituent historical predecessors. So we can point to particular financial legacies in those ways, and individuals like William Hankey. Also a later treasurer, Sir Culling Eardley Smith, is someone else who was a plantation owner who received compensation to emancipation. But also we are mindful, as we're trying to work this through, that the London Missionary Society belonged to this emerging Industrial Revolution class, the mercantile class, and there were those who were particularly involved in forms of industry that were complicit in enslavement. So whether that, for example, in Wales with wool, or Scotland in terms of tobacco and so on, we are just knitted into the system and structures that prospered from the slave trade and perpetuated the slave trade, even to the extent that in the early days when missionaries are being transported, slave ships are used. So we see that some of these direct and indirect legacies, when confronted, London Missionary Society leaders told the missionaries to say nothing about freedom, keep quiet, don't stir up revolt, don't give the slaves the hope of liberation. So all of this kind of comes together as a sense of owning our story.
And what does the process of reparational justice actually mean to you at the Council for World Mission?
It's a moment of confession and repentance. So it's both an act of shame, but it's also a commitment to change. We've been challenged particularly to understand that this is not something we can just give to give back to ourselves. And that's been a very kind of clear piece in how we're trying to shape things. And to understand the truth telling that's required for this work requires truth acting, that we need to follow this through. We are committed to creating change in our communities, but also change in our systems and structures.
Yeah, I think that having participated in the stages that I have been invited to in CWM's process, I can see that it's involved stakeholders and there's been a strong emphasis on redistribution, compensation and generating agency, which are all so important in the whole process. In this process, it's really important to think who is asking different bodies to do this work, on whose mandate, and who are these constituencies that this work seeks to report for, seeks to action change for? The principle of consultation and participation has to be present. And all those who work to seek to establish an understanding of reparations must connect and be responsive to and be guided by movement strategies on reparations. And I think that that's been really clear in CWM's approach so far.
Right. I know that the CWM, the Council for World Mission, has been working on this for a long time and thinking about it deeply for a long time. Can you take me through your process so far?
We set it up through 2017 and 2018 with four hearings, one in UK, one in Ghana, one in Jamaica, and one in the US. There was a gathering in which we recognized the history and legacies of slavery in our story and our communities there, and then moved to contemporary manifestations of that in our lives still, and then to a period of kind of processing what we had been hearing. We made space for lament, and we made space for pain and for hearing that and sharing that and acknowledging that. And then out of those dialogues, the group brought forward ideas, thoughts, reflections, recommendations. There was a core group of people who went through all of the hearings, and they were the ones who produced a report for CWM, and that gave this kind of critical voice and also an independent voice. Some of those participants were members of CWM churches, but not all, and therefore that gave a kind of consistent perspective through the experience.
Yeah, the hearings were really painful. I read in one of your reports on this that some people were quite worried early on in the hearings process that the hearings might just be talk without outcome. And I'm quoting from your report, the hearings might have had African and African descendant people reliving the traumas of racism without creating space for white people to address and own their part in racism and white privilege. How did you collectively manage that?
I think we are still managing that, and we are still at risk of this. This is a critique that, you know, has to be levelled and remain with us and humble us and guide us properly and what we're doing and what's happening through the cultures that we've largely created. But because that's accompanied by people of African and African descent, it keeps a degree of honesty, let's say, and we hope that will continue to play out. I think what's key to this, certainly for us as a mission organisation, is how it reshapes our culture.
And with the hearings, I wonder if you can give me a sense of who you were speaking with in, for example, Ghana or Jamaica, and what sort of really stood out for you?
So in each place, we try to engage, obviously, with church communities, but we try to involve and include activists and also academics, both so that we could name the history and the contemporary legacies reasonably accurately. There were young people engaged as well as older people. We tried to ensure gender balance. At each place, we went to sacred places. So in London, we went to West India Docks. We went to Elmina, the slave citadel on the coast in Ghana. We went to the Maroon Village in Jamaica. And we went to the Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, which was burned down by white racists, including the killing of four children coming out of Sunday school. So this also formed part of the excoriation that we went through together as human beings in that space. In Ghana, we met with one of the chiefs. We also met with African Americans who had decided to repatriate to Africa to settle in Ghana, and also came to share with us, invited us all into their place, and shared their very real challenge and deep suspicion and hostility, quite rightly, to white people present, like myself, you know, giving the impression that, you know, we can be trusted and this work can be done honestly. But in all these ways, critical voices stood out, and that pierced the lies, let's say, but it also opened a way forward. And I think we're still trying to live that out. But there are many moments of realization, and certainly for other white participants who went through, you know, I think a deep conversion experience, really, through the process, hearing these realities which they've either known but ignored or not allowed themselves to face. It was also painful in Africa to sit in the context of African people and African descendant people and to navigate the space around, because of poverty, because of the experience of economic injustice, still shaping and crippling and perverting our world and our lives. So deeply painful moments to peer and try and process.
You know, in the reparations movement, they talk about a process of kind of, if it's for us but not with us, it's not authentic. So I think that that has to be really remembered in this. It has to be a structured process within the context of international African social movements for reparations. And those links have to be continually sought out, made, and really explicit. You know, one of the problems more widely in international development is also that consultations are very narrowly conceived and place kind of the emphasis on communities coming in at designed moments that are carefully controlled. Reparations is something else. It's about really designing from the very get-go something that is community-owned, community-derived, community-advocated for.
Right. Let's talk about the audit that you did. I know this process isn't all about money, but it is a really important part of it.
We have reached a certain stage in this work by accepting the report, the findings, committing to the work, and the board of directors has agreed to make £10 million for reparation to work in different ways, and we're working out strategies for that. So we're really only at the beginning of this work. We want to apply a theological principle, sometimes called the Jubilee principle, from Jewish faith and Christian faith perspectives, that there needs to be a multiplier effect. So if we can point to £1 million, as it were, that we ought to increase that by at least sevenfold. And the board took that view, but also extended it.
And in terms of the fund itself, how is it going to be administered and how's it going to be accountable?
There'll be an independent board that's created. the CWM Legacies of Slavery Strategy Board that will include some of CWM's people, because we need to learn from this. But it will be independent and have a larger number of leaders from communities in the spaces we're trying to stand with, leaders, because this is work being done by others who can keep us accountable and intentional. And so we'll oversee how the 10 million is divided in that respect, but also oversee how the work remains creative in our life, and that CWM can learn from the insights and amplify the changes we're trying to make.
The discussions that have taken place have been very much in the context that this isn't just about monetary compensation. You know, remembering that debt is not just monetary, and reparational justice means a whole encompassing of principles that have been carved out by the reparations movement. Five principles of what reparations mean includes restitution, rehabilitation, satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition and relinquishment. In the case of restitution, I think it represents one of the most wide-ranging reparations options, because it can serve to facilitate the return of real and personal property to previous individual owners, provide stolen wages and lost profits to forced laborers, and repatriate tribes and clans to ancestral lands. So when we talk about figures on reparations, I think it's really important to understand that compensation is not the only remedy, and the nature of discussions actually can privilege compensation. But a big part of reparations is the process, and part of this is repair. And repair involves recognition that people exist, and people have their own ideas about the kind of changes that they want to see and how they want to bring them about, which is why the hearings and all of the engagement that Peter described as part of the CWM journey, which is really what would be the basis of Truth Commission in the UK as well, why that's so important.
Yeah. And going back just for a minute about how funds will be dispersed, how will decisions be made about, you know, this amount of money will be apportioned to this place, this organisation, this project?
The strategy that's being developed that will overarch all of that has been developed with a group of people connected to reparatory justice work from UK and from Africa, from the Caribbean and from the US. And that group, in that sense, has been independent to CWM. And that strategy is now going to be presented to the board. The way that's set out is that the board would will the funds to be made available to this independent group, which will, as we say, continue to have CWM presence in it so that we can be engaged in the learning from it. And so £3 million is the figure that's been set aside out of that to enable reparatory renewal, reparatory return, reparatory redistribution. And that would enable impoverishment intervention in Black communities, anti-racism work at community level, international level, and enable the amplifying of Black self-expression through education, the arts, and through theology. These will be worked at within communities. So communities will work to give the criteria and to give the shape to the work that's going to be done. So that would be, in that sense, a kind of figure that would be placed with partners who have credibility and a proven track record, let's say, in delivering in these areas. Our other commitments include the resourcing for racial justice work by member churches, that's true, but also by other partners engaged in the work, and to make that available in the struggle, let's say. And the other £7 million will enable work by communities, church projects, but also others, academic work to further racial justice work in particular struggles and contexts, and also to create a racial justice legal action fund. That we are mindful that enslavement as a human rights violation has legal implications, and the legacies of slavery continue to manifest themselves in issues like police violence, lack of access to justice, and so on. And so another dimension of this is the creation of a fund that communities could call on either for legal support, or indeed to get legal training to become advocates themselves in this kind of area. So these two areas that the fund will basically work alongside are hoped to be about generational and transformational change in grassroots spaces.
Right. You know, one place I'd really love to see engaging in reparative justice processes would be financial institutions in the City of London. You know, it'd be great to see them look at and face their past and their present, actually. What would you say to them? I mean, how do we approach...
I'll have to hear that on your own, or maybe tune in tomorrow if I play that. That was a gentleman from the Council for World Mission, formerly the London Missionary Society, owning up. They have a Legacies of Slavery project that's quite interesting. It came out of left field for me. That's why I go to the TaxCast regularly. It's a monthly feature. Naomi Fowler, the host, and there was another person involved there as well, but I don't have that in front of me. Okay, it's time for the Radio Free Labor. I didn't do a mention earlier in the show. I did get a nice call about putting Greg Palast on, and pointed out that I did play Election Theft Report, or whatever they're calling it now, in the lead up to the 2016 election as well. So time now for an underwriting announcement, and then turn it over to gentle folks here down in the studio. WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. Do what you can when you can do it.
This hour of programming is supported by the listeners of WEFT and by the Champaign Center Partnership, who foster a vibrant, inviting, and active core downtown, midtown, and campus town by strengthening businesses and building community. The CCP vision is to create healthy and vibrant micro-urban areas for residents and visitors through marketing, advocacy, and special events. CCP encourages and educates the public to shop locally throughout the year. Local businesses need your help more than ever. When you spend $100 at a locally owned business, $68 stays in your community. For more information about the Champaign Center Partnership, visit them on their website.